But then when Ibrahim bought his baklava out, you know, that was it, right? That was it. Deal done, right? They were like, are you the madman who sends us 72 pages, destroys our factory? I said, yeah, I'm the same guy.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Today, I have with me a very special guest, Sheikh Tawfiq Chowdhury, who is the executive chairman of Mercy Mission, is someone that I've long wanted to speak to you and ask a whole bunch of questions. So this is like a, you know, dream come true for me. I want to go through all of your, you know, I think you're like a slightly heterodox perspective on life. You know, so you became a scholar, you became a businessman, you're very, very involved in the charity space. You know, you're thinking about doing things in a different way. But I want to start first, Sheikh, with, you know, your early story. So, you know, there was like a period of, You were born in Bangladesh. You went to Saudi Arabia. You grew up there. And there's a period of atheism in your story as well.
Yeah,
and then you
yeah.
went to Medina. How did that whole thing happen?
So I was born into a bit of a secular Bengali family. Religion wasn't important to us, though. You know, my mom did go for Umrah. My father did go for Hajj. But then it was you know. The danger at that time was if you were too Islamic, you'd become, you know, marginalized. You'd be identified as a Jamaat Islami. You'd be identified as a Shibir, which is like a, you know, apparently certain people that identified with Islam and then used to kill people. So, you know.
In Bangladesh.
Yeah, in Bangladesh. So there were all these sort of negative connotations with becoming practicing. And there was no one really of knowledge or any sort of piety in my family other than my great-great-grandmother and, of course, my great-grandfather. However, they weren't scholars. They weren't ulama. They were just simple, righteous people praying their daily prayers.
And they were still alive?
At that point, they were. Oh. But they were obviously, they had become of very old age. And so, you know, the rest of the family, extended family, was pretty much out of control in terms of their disbelief. I personally, you know, grew up in Saudi, but didn't learn anything of the deen. Went off to Australia when I was about 16. Lived with an Australian family, and it was at that time that I went into a special needs class. Not because I was special needs; it was special because we were chosen because we were exceptional in academics. So it was called a special needs class, you know, out of fun.
Yeah,
and we were given access to university level studies, and it was at that time that I was introduced to some of the theories and philosophies from Plato and Aristotle and others, and we started to disbelieve in Allah. And we unbeknown to my parents, that's when I guess disbelief entered my heart. Yeah, mm.
And so they were all, even before then, you were kind of nominally Muslim still,
by name,
right?
You know, if someone, you know, I would probably say agnostic, not really sure who I am, what I am, trying to figure this out. And it was at that point that I remember I'm a bit of a mathematician. I was doing my calculations of when I feel the world is going to implode again, because we know that the universe is expanding and then it will start to contract again. So we thought, okay, let's try and work this out. So, you know, it was at that time that I was into this thinking that there was literally no God. Yeah.
And what was the shift?
The shift was, the shift was university. When I finished my high school, I did quite well in my academics, and I went into University of Melbourne University in medicine. And it was at that time that I met some brothers at the Muslim table. And, you know, Ibrahim was his name. He gave me some baklava. I said, oh, you like baklava? I said, I love baklava. So why don't you come to the prayer room? There's more there. So I used to just go there just for the baklava. But Ibrahim was smart. He was like, oh, okay, why don't you just do wudu? I said, what do you mean? What the hell's wudu?
Yeah.
So this is how you do it. Just wash your face, wash your hands, and just come and pray. So it was like a... And he was quite smart that, oh, you like, you know, borak as well? You know, my mom makes a really nice borak. And so out of food, you know, he used to drag me into the prayer room. And I went there just for food. And because my mom used to give me curry stuff, which would smell in the morning. Because, you know, by the time it was lunchtime, it would be smelling in my bag. So I should throw it away. So I was literally, you know, hungry.
Yeah.
So I used to go to prayer room just for food. And that's how slowly Islam entered into my heart.
Wow.
And then... I remember what happened was I still didn't believe much until anatomy class, which was we were dissecting a really big lady that was my cadaver. And when I was dissecting, was extremely impressed with the way that the whole human body was created and the intricate details. And that's when it became clear to me that it's not possible for a cyclone to go through a car yard, a secondhand car yard, and a scrap heap, and then suddenly you get a jumbo 747, because that's exactly what they're claiming. What atheists are claiming is that all of this miraculous creation came through just very simple chance, which is nonsense. It's like giving a bunch of typewriters to a bunch of monkeys, and then suddenly you get Shakespeare. What are you talking about? That doesn't happen, you know? This randomness, and also not just randomness, but the fact that this randomness is happening billions of times a day, right? And not just that, but the fact that the DNA molecules, not the fact that they've just come together, the fact that they've come together and now they benefit knowledge, and it came together in a way where it can be replicated, that leads to proteins that lead to a complex human being. All of this was very, very clear to me that there's intent behind it and there's a creator behind it. That's when Imam started to creep in. And then one thing happened, which was my uncle bought me a Walkman, which was those cassette Walkmans. You know, used to play that?
Yeah.
So he bought me a Walkman. So I used to listen to a lot of Michael Jackson at that time. And then suddenly my dad had, you know, in my house, he had a box of cassettes, and one of them was a Quran one. I was like, oh, okay, what the hell is this? So I just put it in, and there was a man that was crying a lot there, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it was the end of the last juz, and he was in the dua of the Khatm al-Quran, and he was crying. So I used to love the way he cried. So I used to listen to it a lot. And before I knew it, within 1 week, I had listened to it so many times, and I just listened. I had memorized juz amma without realizing.
Wow.
And so what had happened was Ibrahim was once reciting in the Maghrib prayer. And, you know, I was embarrassed there. I was like, no, I wonder what am I doing here? So I came literally for his baklava and his basbousa. And he had a couple of pieces left. So I had that. And then suddenly, you know, Ibrahim looked at me. I felt embarrassed because I was eating his food.
Yeah.
So I came and I joined. And he made a mistake in one of the surahs. So I corrected him because I just knew it. Like, that's not what it is.
Yeah.
It's not, this is not the verse right after. So I corrected him. He said, oh, you know juz amma. From now on, you're an imam.
Oh, no.
So there's this guy who doesn't really believe in God yet, and now he's the imam.
Yeah.
So that's how Islam, you know, Allah dragged me in, you know.
Yeah.
Dragged me into faith. And so this is how Islam came into my heart.
Alhamdulillah. And was that all in your first year? How long did that period take?
About 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, all in the first year.
And that's really, you know, I find that really fascinating that there's like, that sure, there was like the intellectual piece there, but actually it was the human connection.
Mm-hmm.
And
very much so.
And I was reflecting, and you know, slightly jumping around, but you know, after the Fath Makkah, Rasulullah, I think in the Battle of Hunain, he gave some of the leaders of Quraysh big amounts of the booty, right? I think Sufyan radiallahu anhu and someone else, maybe Suhail, I think Suhail ibn Amr,
right,
and someone else. And I was kind of thinking about that, about, you know, how that's a very human thing, but it's actually an important part of how, you know, behaviors and mindsets and even thinking changes.
Right. It's not our disagreement or fight against atheism, etc., can be corrected much by just correcting our character. We don't necessarily have to fight this battle on an intellectual, you know, battlefield, because at the end of the day, we know Islam is superior intellectually. You cannot defeat Islamic theology to a sane person. You just cannot. However, they tend to continue to fight simply because, you know, they haven't seen from us anything else. And definitely good akhlaq trumps, logical reasoning and intermittent and all these intellectual arguments trumps it by far, absolutely. And if somebody wanted to argue with me, is there a God or not, you know, I would have 1,000 arguments. But then when Ibrahim bought his baklava out, you know, that was it, right? That was it. Deal done, right?
That's it. That's the baklava that gets
that
you.
That's the baklava, man. That's it. I'm telling you.
And what, do you know Ibrahim still?
Yeah, Ibrahim is such a beautiful man. He doesn't know, you know, what his small deed led to it, but rubba dirham in sabaqat miyat alf, you know, perhaps one dirham has surpassed 100,000, you know,
Allah.
And this is why, and his mom is the one who doesn't even know me. Do you know what I mean? She's the one who really cooked it.
She's the one who cooked it.
Isn't that right? Amazing, isn't it? And so if Allah accepts the work that I'm doing now, can you imagine Ibrahim or his mom would come on the Day of Judgment like, what's this? I said, this is for you.
This is the baklava.
This is the baklava.
It's right? Crazy, isn't it?
Amazing. Amazing, Allah.
And Sheikh, you strike me as a man who doesn't do things by halves. And I don't know this part of your story at all. My sense is that once you were in, you know, you kind of become a Muslim full on, you really leaned into it. And then I'd love to hear what that looked like and then how you ended up in Medina.
I can't do anything half-hearted. I can't. If I love something, I will put all my attention to it. And that's been my story across my life in academics. If I focus, I had to defeat everybody and beat everyone. I just had to. It's not because of, see and conquer, not sort of attitude. It's just that I just needed to find out who I am and what the best of my ability was. So once I discovered Islam, that was it. Even in medical school, I was literally listening to Islamic lectures and talks. So there was a Quran and Sunnah Society at that time. I bought hundreds of their tapes. I listened to everybody and everyone. That wasn't enough. So then I found Maulana Maududi's Tafsir, Rahimahullah. And then I read everything. And I read it probably three, four, five times. And then I was like, no, that's not enough. And then I went to Melbourne University, the Arabic section. There were rows and rows and rows of Arabic books. And I said, oh, Allah, teach me Arabic. Oh, Allah, teach me Arabic. I've got, you know, I need to read this. And I can't read it. Then I found Abu Ayyub, an Iraqi professor of language that was exiled in Melbourne. And I said, Abu Ayyub, you've got to teach me. And he started from, Nahu, right? It's Alfiya of Ibn Malik. I was like, what do you mean? I was like, come, Alfiya is easy, man. Come on. I was like, and he started with Alfiya. And I'm like, I've got no idea of the alif of the Alfiya. You know what I'm saying? And so that didn't work. Then I signed up for Arabic as a second language program along with my medicine. In my second year, I took Arabic as an international diploma program in Melbourne University.
So he is as a new Arabic student. Yeah. He's a let's go Alfiya.
Yeah, he's got Alfiya, right? And then I went to.
Do you know it now? Be like,
yeah, of course, we had to study. We had to study Alfiya in Medina. I think we took a vast majority of Alfiya in our 4 years.
And you have to memorize it still?
No, but I didn't memorize Alfiya. Yeah. But I did. We did study quite well. The first year was terrible for me in Alfiya, but the second year I had a Mauritanian teacher, and it was like language and grammar was like asal. You know, I used to drink asal from his mouth. You know, and he was amazing. That's when I fell in love with the Arabic language, and I couldn't speak English anymore after that. It was just Arabic. Yeah. And then I said, okay, look, I'm going to do an advanced diploma in modern languages. And then there was a Jewish lady teaching me Arabic, right? And I was like, this, and she was teaching me how to pick up girls in a pub in Arabic. So I definitely learned how to do that. But I've got no idea how to understand the hadith.
Yeah.
So that didn't help. Then I said, okay, final strategies. Got to work. I've got to marry an Arab girl. Right, that definitely should work, right? Yeah. Must be. So then I started searching for all these Arab girls to marry.
That was the most fun bit of your journey.
That was a fun one. Didn't tell my parents, right? So I tried everything. And then it just didn't work. And then I found, finally, my wife, a Lebanese girl, right? And then I ended up teaching her Arabic. So that didn't work. So that's when I said, you know, this is not going to work. Right? I tried everything. That's it. I have to go to some place where I can study Arabic. So you know, I was really passionate. Then these professors from Medina came, Sheikh Abdullah Tawajiri and Sheikh Sultan, Hafidhullah, amazing, beautiful men. And they interviewed me in my Dawah center, and they said to me, to my face, they said, you're Indian, Hindi. We didn't come to Australia to take Hindis, you know, you came here to get Aussies. So we will not accept you. I said, with tears in my eyes, it's not up to you, mate. You do the interview.
Yeah.
It's not up to you. Literally, I was that rude to them. Mm. It's not up to you. You just make sure you do the interview, and then we'll leave it to Allah Azza wa Jal. And what I used to do is I used to get my paperwork, and they gave me a fax number if they wanted to add anything. Every week, I sent them 72 pages of fax every week. Every single week, I sent them 72 pages. Until I remember once I got accepted into Medina, they were like, are you the madman who sends us 72 pages, destroys our facts? I said, yeah, I'm the same guy. That's because you didn't accept me. And you told me you're not going to accept me. So I said, make sure that you're going to accept me.
And how many weeks did you do that?
I did that for 40 weeks. until I got accepted. Yeah. I'm telling you, persistence, man, you know?
And it's not easy to fax things as well.
So it was very expensive at that time. So like $50 I would spend every week.
It takes time.
Just to send a fax to Medina at that time.
Wow.
Yeah, but I was very determined. I had to do it.
The $2,000 worth of faxing.
That was quite a lot, yeah. SubhanAllah, Ya Rab. But that was very much worth it because I got accepted. And my life started to change, you know? And that's when I went to Medina. Then I realized that I'm not going to learn anything in this university because this is nonsense, really. The university itself was catered for academic knowledge, but you don't learn anything in the university. I think 5% of what I know right now is in the university. It's the fact that I use the opportunity university to be completely mutafarriq for ilm, for completely free from knowledge.
Yeah.
And then I found the students of Shanqiti, hafidhahullah.
Yeah.
Muhammad Mukhtar Shanqiti. I latched onto them for 6 years. Until I learned as much fiqh as I can, I read all of Mughni to them, and I think I read Mughni to them 4 or 5 times.
Do you like the fiqh?
I love fiqh. Fiqh is like, you know, at night would be, so Abu Hanifa, what do you say about this? And Ahmed, what do you say about that? Shafi, what is your refutation? It's logical because I like logic, you see. And when it was logical argumentation, that's what really, really appealed to me. So I focused only on fiqh and only 1 year or 2 years on aqidah. I saw most of our modern du'a today didn't do that. They were left, right, and center, you know, la ilaha ula wa la ilaha ula mudabdab. And so as a result, I don't think they really learned anything. At first year, second year, they used to call me Majnoon of Shanqiti. Because I was blind following him, Shanqiti, and everything he said.
Yeah.
And
you've already got a reputation because of the fax machines.
So. Yeah, so definitely. But it was so beneficial because then I had an asl. Yeah. I had an asl. When I'm tired, I know one answer to a question that people ask me. And I think I asked my sheikhs over 3,000 questions in fiqh. And I would have spent over 7,000-8,000 hours studying fiqh with them. And it was the best part of my life, you know. And I remember there were 3 classes that I missed because people came to visit me from Australia. And there were 3 classes. Till now, I have difficulty with those topics in fiqh. But I became so focused on fiqh that I remember starting to come to England in the year 2000 or 2002, 2003, when Rahim found me. Invited me to Jimma's conference. And I came here.
I remember those days.
Remember those days?
Yeah.
So when they invited me initially, first few years, I said, I'm not going to teach anything. People used to get angry. What do you mean not going to teach anything? I said, because I'm still a student. I'm still learning. And then I started to start teaching when I was in my 3rd year of Sharia. And when I started to do that, my first courses were fiqh of tahara, fiqh of salah, fiqh of zakat, fiqh of jihad even. And just the fiqh of it, right? Not anything else behind it. And then fiqh of menstruation. And, you know, we're teaching all of that. And that became the basis for my Al-Kawthar courses.
Right. That's an incredible journey. And were you in the same period as people like Sheikh Yasir Qadi, Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif?
Yeah, we were very close.
Sheikh Wajid.
Sheikh Muhammad al-Sharif, rahimahullah, was finishing off those years. We had become friends at that time in Medina, but he was in his final years. Yasir Qadi, we became very close. We were going to write books together. Our children were friends. Our wives were friends. When Yasser went through a lot of difficulty in Medina, I was with him. But I decided to leave before him, finish off and not do a master's there. And I came back whilst he carried on, finished his master's, and then went back to the US.
And where did you go back? Back to the
US? I went back to Australia.
Right.
I was preparing for my master's in fiqh because, you know, I wanted to do that. But Dad said, come back. And I thought it was enough. I'm going to come back. I came back and I restarted medicine again from zero.
Wow.
And that's when I finished my medicine. At that point, that's when I started Mercy Mission as well.
Amazing. So, Sheikh, how old were you at this point?
Oh, wow. Okay. So, went into medicine 17, went to Medina at the age of 19, 20. Finished Medina about 26, 27. So back to Australia at the age of 26, 27.
Okay. And I want to spend like the next, I guess, half of this just, you know, getting really kind of, you know, deep into execution yes. and strategy.
Yes.
So at that point, how are you thinking about, you know, your roadmap and what led to Mercy Mission?
So I saw people, you know, Medina was amazing. You know, just in my class, which had 70 students, was 32 nationalities. On my right was somebody from Chechnya. On my back was somebody from, you know, from India. In front of me, somebody from US. And then Hood Bradford, Sheikh Hood, was with me all the time in my class. So it was an amazing experience. But no one really knew what they were going to do with their life when they finished. Very disillusioned. Some people thought, okay, I'm going to come back and do a masjid. Some thought, you know, okay, I'll join on Maghrib, etc. For me, it became clear to me, my vision became clear in my last year in Medina when I finished my Qawaid al-Fiqh. So my Qawaid al-Fiqh, unfortunately, they teach it only in the fourth year in Sharia. But that was what, when I remember Sheikh Sulaiman Ruhili, rahimahullah, hafizahullah, when he was teaching me, and I got really angry at the Sheikh. I said, you know, right, only now you're teaching me this? This is what I came for. To understand why Allah wants and what Allah wants with our life in the 21st century. You're only answering it at the sixth year. Don't you get it? This is a knowledge that needs to start off at the beginning and perhaps another summary at the end, right? And you need to wrap the knowledge. This is Qawaid al-Fiqh.
Like the Usul type thing?
Or no, it was Usul al-Fiqh. It's Maqasid. Mm. It's Maqasid al-Sharia and Qawaid al-Fiqh. Yeah, Maqasid al-Sharia. It's like, what does Allah, what is the real purpose of the Sharia? Mm. Why does Sharia want to cut your hand off?
The philosophical underpinning.
Yeah, the philosophical underpinning or the thinking of Allah, the reasoning of Allah behind his ahkam. And that is what made the most sense to me. So that's why even when I started Al-Kawthar, I started off with Qawaid al-Fiqh first. Because I understand the modern Western thinking. It's like you need to understand why before you understand what.
Mm.
And unfortunately, Islam and the way we are taught is all about what. And then the why comes so like minuscule. I said, that's complete nonsense. You've got to start off the other way, right? Because we are being attacked into thinking that, you know, Islam is completely illogical religion in a medieval bubble. We're inappropriate for the 21st century. So explain the why, it's relevant. And then the what will come later, inshallah. So in everything I do in my life from now on, the why is far more important than the what. In fact, I don't care about the what at all these days. And I leave it to people smarter than me about the what and how. In fact, the how is probably, if anybody talks about the how in front of me, I probably shoot them down. I say, you know what, you just, because you know how becomes the way, the fulcrum of the shaitan, I call it. I mean, you know, it's like, let's say for example, let's say, we're going to launch a bank.
Hmm.
First thing is, they don't even ask why. The first thing is like, what? What bank? Okay, Sharia compliant Islamic bank in UK. The next question is always, how? What do you mean you're going to launch a bank? We don't have any money. We don't have this. We don't have a license. And that's when I was just like, you know, come here. Do you disbelieve that Allah can do everything? Do you disbelieve that? No. Then believe that Allah can do it. We're doing it. And the reason why we're doing it is this. So all I do is concentrate myself on 10 hours with my team on why we need to do a bank. You see, when you drive, if we are marooned on an island.
Yeah. Do you want to do a bang?
I do.
All right, let's do a bang.
Let's do it. So if you're marooned on an island, you want to get off the island, right? There's two ways of doing it. The typical way, which most people do, right, which annoys the hell out of me, is like, okay, Abdullah, you guys get the wood, and over you, yeah, you guys get the rope, get that mate, and you, can you just get some fish done, cook some fish so that we can eat whilst we're doing all that. And then they try to make the boat, and then they try and get off the island, and then the waves come crashing down, and then they break, and then, you know, they give up because, you know what, they tried, and the second try, third try. But if you can drive them mad, but hey, what do you miss about the UK?
Mm.
UK is my wife, UK is my home, UK is a hot shower, UK is amazing food, right? And what else do you miss about UK? And you drive them wild, passionate, mad in their love for going back home. I'm telling you, they will find the best strategies.
They'll do it,
They will do it. You don't have to do anything. And you'll learn from them. Like, wow, I didn't think about that. Oh, yeah. You know what I'm saying? And even when they fail, they will try again. Because they're like, okay, now we learned how not to do it.
Mm.
Instead of, you know, we failed. It's not a failure. It actually becomes just a trial for them.
Yeah.
And that's what I've learned about human behavior. It's about the why. It's never about anything else. It's about the why. So I needed to know why. I need to, why did Allah create me? So I learned that that was the reason why Allah wanted Sharia and why Sharia is important with Qawaid al-Fiqh Maqasid al-Sharia. And then I was, I was really, really looking for a purpose for myself. Like, why does Tawfiq exist? And why the hell did I leave my medicine? You know, I came third out of Australia in my academics. So I was academically top, right? And Medina did fairly well. Like, why? And then one day I was just passing by the grave of Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam in the Rawda, and praying in the Rawda, and I was just passing by again, thinking about what am I going to do with my life? And a thought just came to me saying that, you know, if you want to follow this man here, not enough to just simply pray how he prayed and fast how he fasted. You have to do with your life what he would have done had he been alive.
Mm.
That was it. Just the way that was phrased was enough for me to know that my purpose was to fulfill the vision of the final messenger. So I came back home and I said, okay, lock my room in my study. And I took a whiteboard and I took all these sticky pads and I said, okay, what would Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam have done right now if he was alive right now? Okay, he would have helped the poor, he would have supported the final revelation, he would have done this, that, etc. Put 50,000 things that I feel the Prophet would have done, then I started tagging them along and I grouping them together and I put them into 9 groups. That became my DNA document of my vision.
Brilliant.
Right? And that's how I put my ideas together. Does that make sense how I thought
it? It does, yeah. What are the 9?
Yeah, sorry?
What are the 9?
So the 9, I don't remember all of the 9 right now, but one of them, for example, is he would have preserve the final revelation, okay? Or he would have preached the final revelation.
Yeah.
He would have, for example, taught the next generation.
Yeah.
He would have defended the borders of Islam.
Mm.
Yeah. Another one would be, for example, he would have invited people of other faith to our belief. Mm. Yeah. He would have, healed the sick. And looked after the poor. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
He would have looked after the Bayt al-Mal. So I wrote down all of these 9 categories, yes? And once I categorized them all together, I needed to summarize it into a vision. I did that many years later into the vision for my life. And that became the vision of Mercy Mission, to achieve a world where every Muslim can live faithfully to their belief, building an exemplary Islamic community that benefits humanity.
Yeah.
So that was
sounds like something Khwan Naseem would.
He probably he would have got it from me because he joined me a lot later. I think 3-4 years later. But yes, yeah. Correct. So that became the vision. That became that became our vision. And then of course we had our purpose, which was very clear, which is to achieve the eternal pleasure of Allah Almighty by striving with excellence to pursue the vision of the final messenger. And that used to drive everybody wild, you know. That was enough to bring in the best of the best people. And from the people that work with me now, each one of them can launch their own organizations. They don't need to follow me, work with me, but they do because of the power of the way that we're able to communicate our vision to them.
Mm. Yeah, and so Sheikh, what's the? I guess this is a good point to think about. You know, the charity space generally. Sure. What makes Mercy Mission special? And how are you, cogs and wheels operationally structuring it that is different, and what can potentially other charity people learn from it?
So I think what makes us very different and special is because we have a real focus on why Mercy Mission needs to exist. If we felt Mercy Mission didn't need to exist, we would not do it. And we because of the fact that we feel that the vision of the final messenger has yet to be serviced, there are huge holes in the Swiss cheese model of the Dawah that we have developed today, that we believe that there was a deep need for an organization like Mercy Mission, a social entrepreneurial community development organization that would focus on filling in the holes in the Swiss cheese model. So if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs and you developed a human, you developed a structure for the humanity, based on that, some communities are at the lowest level, which is, I call it off the boat mentality. Off the boat mentality, they're still the blue collar workers, masjids, halal food. Then comes civic pride, which is where British Muslims were or still are, which is, I'm a proud British Muslim. Yeah. And that's where they need their schools and their funding institutes, and they'll need their zakat agencies.
Yeah.
Then you've got a fulcrum that projects them into the next stage, which is media.
Yeah.
So that's when Islam Channel, and all of these media came across, right? Yeah. That became the fulcrum. That gave voice to us, right? That pushed us into the next level, which is the deep roots. And that became the roots upon which we go into society. And that's, for example, the deep roots are, for example, South African Muslims, 300 years, 200 years in South Africa. So they have become deep roots. They are ingrained in society, you know? And so, and just like the Jews are ingrained here in this society, deep roots, we call it. And that's when you need your universities, you need your think tanks, and you need your
politicians.
Yeah, politicians, lobby groups, right? You need people in parliament. You need patrons of the arts. You need all of those sort of people. Right?
Venture capitalist.
And then finally, it's called responsibility. Well, Allah might give you a country to run, such as, for example, Erdogan and Turkey. So that is your responsibility. This is the way I think in my life, okay? Wherever I go with Mercy Mission, my same vision applies, but my strategy changes according to Maslow's hierarchy of needs on this structural map over here. And that's how I frame my thinking. And what projects I focus on in each of them depends on Maqasid al-Sharia, on the goals and purposes of the Sharia, which is first preserve the deen. If not, then you preserve life. And then thereafter, you preserve your progeny and your honor, and then comes wealth, right?
Yeah.
So the four or the five Maqasid al-Sharia, that gives me my clarity on what I should be focusing on first, right? And when I focus on those five things, first thing I do is do anything that attacks it. So first projects should be about defending the faith, removing anything that reduces our life, anything that hurts our mind and our progeny and our wealth. And then that which promotes our deen, promotes our health. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So first we do no harm before we do good. And with all of these qawaid and these principles, I've developed my projects that we do in Mercy Mission. So one, this is why there is a huge ideological clarity behind the work I do, which is born of my belief in Islam and my training in Islam and my understanding of Maqasid al-Sharia. It's not random ideas that I follow. It's very logically connected. But of course, I do.
And have you like documented that anywhere?
Yes, that's my DNA document. Yes,
right.
Correct.
Have you made that public?
No.
Will you?
One day, they asked me to write a book about it. I'm 46 at the moment. I thought, like, wait till I'm 50. Because I tend to think that, you know, I'm not ready yet. But I might do so, inshallah.
I think you should. Because like that's the thing that then gives a lot more people a crack at.
A clarity at it.
The roadmap.
Right. People have been asking me to do so. I might do it, inshallah. Mm. But at this point in time, I just wanted to validate my idea, whether it even works and if it's correct or not.
Yeah.
So far, so good. So far, so good. The other thing that I have also done is I've created something called vision, and you've got your purpose and your vision. Then I've created a set of rules, a bit like when you're skiing down a hill and you've got these poles, you need to ski in between these poles, right? These flags and poles. So created certain rules that I believe have to be abided by. And those rules is what has enabled me to accelerate my strategy. And an example of a rule, for example, is number one or number two in anything I do.
Mm.
Number one or number two in anything I do. If I cannot be number one, number two within 3 years, in any sector that I enter, then I stop and I shut it down and I close it and I just give my project to somebody else. Okay? If I'm not number one, number two, I will stop doing it. And that's why Mercy Mission is seen in a good light, because our projects are number one or number two in what we do. Otherwise, we just shut it down. We just don't do it.
You're like a VC in many ways. So I come from like a startup space.
Right.
And what you want to do is, you know, cull the bad ideas quickly. Let the winners run.
Let the winners run, right? And cut your losses, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We've got to do that. Time is short. Shaitan's after us. Angel of death is looking for his appointment with us. We ain't got time. Not enough money.
Yeah.
And we've got a billion people to guide, right?
Yeah.
So that's it. Stop doing something which doesn't work. That's nonsense. Don't tell me it's your passion. This is what I hate today. It's like, oh, yeah, follow your passion. What nonsense are you talking about? And, oh, yeah, follow your dreams. Look, yeah, bloody hell. And then, no, that's not what it is. Do what's right and understand what you're good at.
Yeah.
And then love the thing that you're doing and then make yourself love it.
Yeah.
Right? Even if you hate it now, a day will come when you'll love it because you know you're good at it. right? And you'll know, kullu muyassarin lima khuliqa lak. So everyone is helped by Allah to do what he is, what he has been created for. So figure that out. Figure out your purpose, and you'll find amazing that you'll find that Allah Azza wa Jal will give you amazing success when that marries together with what you're doing.
Sheikh, I wanted to segue into the business, but we were having this discussion a few days earlier, right, around charities and how they manage money, finances, and I feel like there's a lot of money in the Muslim community, particularly in the charity sector, and I feel like the way that they deploy that and manage that can have a real bearing on, you know, because they're the irrigation, they control the irrigation lines of the Muslim community, and if those guys are not pointing in the right direction, it affects the Muslim community. I'd love to get your sense on that, and then we follow the water down this irrigation line, and let's get into business as well.
Yes. One of the things that that annoy me a lot when I hear trustees and CEOs saying that we are bound by the expectation of donors. You know, that annoys the hell out of me because it's kalimatul haq yurid biha batin. You know what that means? Meaning that it's a statement of truth. Of course, the donor's given it to you, you need to use it for the purpose that he's given it. But it's kalimatul haq, but yurid biha batil. And batil is that you just do whatever the donors want. I mean, if we do whatever the donors want, the world will be full of just masajid. Right? Because the donors just want masjid and they just want to look after orphans. That's it.
Yeah.
There's nothing else of the whole infrastructure of the ummah would be done.
We'll have a lot of wells,
right? We'll have a lot of wells.
The one in London.
One in London, right?
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, because that's what the donors know. They just, you know, when they are emotional, they just think about the most, whatever comes to their mind. And the shaitan makes them think about the least of the things and then take them away from the greater of the things. We wouldn't focus on schools when schools are far more important today than many masajid are, because we have enough masajid, for example. We would focus on imam development rather than the masjid, because you can't just have a brick and mortar without the people to run it. And that's what happens in Indonesia. I found 10,000 masjids and 5,000 of them where actually sheep are grazing in the masjids because there's no imam anymore to lead it. I've literally seen masajid where there are sheep grazing in the masjid because there's no imam to lead it. Now, what was the purpose of this? And this is why, you know, I pick fights with a lot of the dawah organizations, because they're like, oh, mashallah, banayna ashara alaf masajid, mashallah, mashallah. You know, we basically they said, oh, we built 10,000 masjids. I said, you know what? You built 10,000 graves. That's what you built. They are just bricks and mortar. Masjids are thriving places. If you don't build the people with it, you will simply have just a brick and mortar. We've seen that happen. We don't want that to happen. We want today trustees that understand that you want to motivate and educate the donor. When you do that, initially you take a step back. Initially, donations are less. Initially, yes, you're right, it doesn't work. But if you focus on educating the donor, you will get the donations where you want it. You will get the donations where you want it. I mean, can you believe I have raised tens of millions for schools? I have raised tens of millions for TV channels. I have raised tens of millions for weird projects that I believe should be done because I have stood in front of the donor and convinced him that a masjid is not the right thing to donate to.
Yeah.
You should be donating to that project, right? Like telehealth project, for example, which we did in Pakistan and India. Yeah, telehealth project. And, you know, which donor thinks telehealth is important? Well, it was important. We could get healthcare to remote areas through just a motorbike, you know? So, and we could send a SMS-based script to them, which was amazing. But that was not in the donor's mind. They were thinking something else. So it's very critical that our trustees and our CEOs of our charities understand their real role, and that is to create their own vision, clarify it, and then to educate the donors. Even if that initially means that you're growing slowly, so be it.
Let me push back on that, Sheikh Taufiq. So, I get it. But a charity guy would say, look, Sheikh, that's easy for you to say, but this is, you know, it's like the prisoner's dilemma. It's a zero-sum game. And if, you know, if someone else is offering the proverbial, you know, candy, here's the water well, and I'm offering them telehealth in Indonesia, that, you know, people are going to go for the candy. And there's only a finite amount of, you know, money out there. And so, and I think that's what happens, right? And then ultimately, they all evolve into just offering candy. What are your thoughts on that?
My thought on this is that we are only touching the surface of the giving. We have so much wealth to give. And I think if we were to look at the amount of giving that we're giving, yes, Muslim community, mashallah, is giving a lot. But total giving in the West, for example, is 0.8% of their net wealth, for example. And so I don't think we've even touched giving yet. If we truly focus on giving, the pot would get far larger. That would be number one. Number two, just because someone else is going to take that money, don't judge yourself on the revenue you earn. That's vanity. Sanity is the impact. Mm. You must judge on your impact. It's not about the number of police officers that you have. It's the amount of crime that you've reduced. You with me? It's not about the amount of money you've collected. It's the amount of impact that you've done with it. Rubba dirhamin sabaqat miyat alf. And that's why I spent yesterday with my trustees in Charity Right and say, okay, look, we are about 5-10 million pound organization. How can we now have the impact of a $50 million organization? That's by making sure that one agenda of ours is not just the same agenda. It's also multiple agendas that we can look at. For example, through feeding, we can also save a child from slavery, for example, and going into the sex slave trade, for example, that's pretty rampant worldwide, you know? And so we want to make sure that we can stop multiple problems with one stone, right? And this is why most of our leaders today in the charity sector and others, they lack strategic thinking. Mm. This ability, this dimension of their leadership called strategic thinking, they don't understand. They leadership is a game of a seesaw between 90-day priorities and 5-year goals. You've got to understand your leadership is between 90-day priorities and your 5-year goals. You can't simply focus on your 90 days because then you lose your track of your 5-year goals.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of our CEOs and our trustees do not understand that. But a day will come when they will understand that those people who have moved into sectors that they are now considering to be not important, they will eventually win. Because you see, the generations are changing. And the generational change is meaning that they don't want to keep putting their money into a big black hole. Mm. That's number one. They want to see real change. And they are also second generation, third generation wealth that's coming in now. We are no longer as stressed as our parents were, who were really worried that their kids were, you know, going to be without a home. Mm. We already have homes. Yeah. And alhamdulillah, we're already well looked after. Now we want strategic change. Mm. We want strength to be developed. That cannot happen except by being strategic in your giving.
Yeah. And Sheikh, there's an interesting, I heard someone say this, that the best wine is apparently from the grapes that have that are grown on rocky outcrops and like have a bit of stress to them.
Yes.
It's not from the ones that are, you know, in the kind of fields and become really fat and juicy.
Absolutely.
Because they're not, they lose that ability.
Absolutely.
And if you think about it, like if a charity is fed on the candies, like, you know, it's kind of, you're kind of, you know, sucking at the teat of the donor every year.
Absolutely.
Sure, it might be harder for a charity that's looking to do something slightly different, but you build the muscle and then over a 10-year period, you know, you've become sustainable.
Absolutely.
And much more impactful.
Absolutely.
And then everything kind of falls away.
Absolutely. And you've got to understand that the retail customer isn't the only charitable donor. They are big institutions and they want to donate too. There's something called CSR funding. There is a legal obligation in certain jurisdictions to give 1 or 2% of their operating income away in CSR. It's actually legally obligated in certain jurisdictions, and that money can be addressed. And a lot of the non-Muslim funds will give to your causes because there's such a huge overlap between our vision and theirs. And so it's very critical that charity sector trustees and leaders start to think a bit more wide. Don't just look at a B2C solution, look at a B2B solution, which is business to business solution. Go out to the funds and speak to them. And they are strategic thinkers. They are not emotionally driven, just like their retail customers. And those people are probably larger. And that's one of the biggest changes I've made in my life since 2015. The last 5 years, people say, oh, Sheikh Chowdhury is no longer in the Dawah scene. I said, what do you mean I'm not in the Dawah scene? I'm just in a different sector, in a different field. I'm actually going towards my destination, if anything, faster, just because I'm doing it a little bit differently.
Yeah, very interesting. I guess, you know, these charities that have to set up slightly differently because, you know, their, I guess, go-to-market will be different. You'll have to learn a different muscle.
But what got you here will not get you there. If you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. If you want to get what you never got, you must do what you never did.
Yeah.
So you can't take your charity from 1 to 5 in the same way as you want to take it from 5 to 50. You can't. And that's the same thinking. You think you're going to get to 50 by using the same strategies, got to 5? And that's the definition of madness.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Sheikh, I wanted to move to business. You're a sheikh who has run and exited hospitals and other entrepreneurial projects. Is it wrong to be rich in Islam?
I don't think so at all. Out of the Ashara Mubashirin Bil Jannah, we know that Zubair ibn Awam was filthy wealthy, right? 56 million dirhams he left as inheritance. 56 million dirhams. And so he's Ashara Mubashirin Bil Jannah. Abdurrahman ibn Auf, so much wealth, so wealthy as it was Abdurrahman ibn Auf, radiallahu ta'ala anhu. So it's not, it is completely. Uthman, oh come on, Uthman, how can we forget Uthman, radiallahu ta'ala anhu, the wealth that he had. It's complete nonsensical to say that, you know, we have to be poor. And you know, how many of the prophets of God were filthy wealthy as well, you know? Ya Dawud, inna ja'alnaka khalifatan fil ard. Fil ard, the whole dunya was given to him. And then Sulaiman, of course, he not just the dunya, and he asked for it, right?
Yeah.
He asked for it, and not just that, look at Yusuf. Ij'alni ala khaza'inil ard, inni hafidhun alim, right? So no, it is not wrong. And I make dua to Allah, O Allah, I am from those slaves of yours who poverty and being poor does not benefit me in any way. Make me wealthy and rich. Make me strong. Yeah. So that's what I pray to God. But with the knowledge that, of course, it does increase your questioning Yawm al-Qiyamah. But as long as your intention is correct and you've given it away before you've died, then alhamdulillah, inshallah, your questioning can decrease as well. So what I would suggest is for all my brothers and sisters to get as strong and as wealthy as possible.
Yeah,
but it does open up a can of filth, okay?
Yeah.
Because money inherently corrupts, yeah? Mm. So you have to surround yourself with people who understand the meaning of money.
Mm.
Money is oxygen. Money is not just earned for the sake of money. Money is oxygen, so you can do more with it. That's why I don't call it money anymore. I call it oxygen. It helps me to understand. I need more oxygen to breathe. I need more oxygen to grow. I need more oxygen to run faster.
Sure.
So that's what gives me clarity in myself, that oxygen is the right thing. Sometimes oxygen, if it's too much, can make you blind. So too much oxygen, when we give it to our children, it makes them blind, right? So we have to control the amount of oxygen as well. So that's how I understand money in my life.
Interesting. And I suppose, you know, we did this like long article or, you know, bit of a brain dump for me on wealth. And I think for some people, it might not be the right thing, right? I feel that different people can handle different amounts of wealth. And you kind of know where you're hitting a limit where, you know, it's affecting, you know, it's going making you go blind, for example.
Yeah, you're right. You need to see, you need to commensurate or match your wealth to your vision that you have in your life. Yeah. After a while, money is no longer useful. It doesn't increase the quality of the food you eat or the type of car that you drive. It doesn't. It only increases you in headache because of the management of that fund. So you need to understand what is the purpose of the reason that you have. I mean, I personally have an intention to become a billionaire. And I don't intend to stop until I do. And not even just the first billion, that'll be now I did it. Now let's replicate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I intend to do that. Now, of course, in that path, it will be very hard. It will be fraught with difficulties. But I would rather choke on greatness rather than revel in mediocrity. And that's exactly what I find people are doing. This reveling mediocrity when really what we should be, you know, dying to achieve greatness, if not, you know, saying that we tried our best.
Absolutely. And Sheikh, what about, because I find that now that we're talking about wealth, you know, I find that certain communities, let's say we were talking to, there's a guy who runs a TikTok channel, YouTube channel called like Jewish Finance. And he talks about how the Jewish community is really good at working together with each other. And we're actually going to do a session with him on like how, you know, how that happens and all that sort of thing.
Nice.
So yeah, watch that one. But, nice. You know, what have you seen in the world of business with Muslims? And, you know, and it's not just business, it's also, you know, politics, media, it's all kind of interrelated after a while.
I've seen Muslims were still first generation. Everyone's worried about their own family, nafsi. That's perfectly fine. Just like kids when you're growing up, everyone is pretty jealous. And my kids don't share. And you got to tell them, Aisha, you got to share your toy with Zainab. You know what I mean? We're at that level at the moment.
Yeah.
Relax. Just give them the first generation.
Yeah.
You know, that's why Musa alayhi salam was not blessed with Jerusalem with the first generation. But it was on Yusha bin Nun. It was after the second generation, their children, who Allah blessed them with Jerusalem, right? So relax. Let's just be calm. First generation. uncle, auntie, chachi, dadi, you know, they just made their all halal food, and now they have a little bit of money, and now they've bought their homes, and now they're so worried, beta, kuch nahi dena, kuch ki,
yeah. Put it all in property.
Put it all in property, right? Everything is in property, and just keep buying more property and whatever else. And now the son is suddenly coming home and saying, Mom, what about cryptocurrency and Ethereum and all that? What the hell is Ethereum? You know what I mean? Take your Ethereum. So he doesn't understand. You know, so this is the challenge.
Dogecoin.
Dogecoin. Yeah. So you're going into that phase where people are now investigating. It's a new generation, yeah. New wealth, right? So I think this is growing pains. Very soon, in about 20 to 30 years, the second generation will have taken that wealth and they will no longer be that afraid. They'll be a bit more entrepreneurial. Second generation, I'm very encouraged by. And the third will be the strategic thinkers, the builders of institutions that last centuries, the banks that they will last centuries, the new Rothschilds that they will yeah. come from the Muslim world. That'll happen.
So, Jeff, let's say there's a, I don't know, there's a 28-year-old woman or man who is in a relatively good profession. They're feeling a little bit aimless and, you know, they're sat in, I don't know, New York or London or Tokyo, wherever, and they're Muslim and they want to do something. What is, you know, what's your message to them?
My message is give everything away in charity. Number one, right? You know me very well. I do not say what you're expecting, right? I will be totally out of the, because I found that it's such people who have radical ideas that actually work. Yeah. They actually work,
yeah.
Right? Okay, so number one, the first thing is who has all money? Allah Rabbul Alameen. Mm. And you have very little right now. You might have a car that's worth 10,000 bucks and you've got a little bit of cash in your accounts. Mm. Number one, the first thing I did when I started business in 2015, mm. I said, look, I wasn't really busy in my medicine. I was very busy studying, working in the da'wah. I had put on a lot of weight. I was really fat at that point. I'm still a little bit overweight, but at that point, you know, I had overlooked many things. So I didn't even have a house. I didn't have a car. I had a car, which was a 2009 BMW i5 series. It was like very little cash in the accounts. I had a property here, a student-led property here in Leeds,
oh, okay.
which was only 30,000 pounds. I bought it whilst I was doing medicine. And then I said, you know what? I can't build a $1 billion empire with this. In fact, it's a distraction. So the first thing I did is gave everything away. Give it all away. Ridiculous. And that's the first thing that I remember that freed my mind up. Okay? First, I gave it all to Allah. So I just, Allah, from my hands to your hands. Mm. Because I trust you and I don't trust myself.
Yeah.
And the money is too small anyway. And for you, it's very little, but I know for one thing is that you blessed the ants until the ants are the largest number of the creation that we can see simply because they gave certain small things to Allah Azza wa Jal. They mm. gave their offering. And that is what caused them to be blessed. And that's what the Mufassirin say. And so I did the same thing. I'm like an ant, Ya Ram, I'm giving you less than what the ants offered you, but you blessed my wealth. Okay, so that's the first thing I did. That's why I tell anybody who wants to make wealth, give everything away to Allah. I know it sounds ridiculous. Oh my God, how am I going to live? I said, you know, put yourself in that fear where you're only calling on Allah purely intently mm-hmm. and you watch what happens. You watch what happens, okay? The second thing I did is, okay, all right, who has all the wealth? I said, billionaires. And I hate millionaires because millionaires are stingy people. They're stingy people. They make $1 million. Then they bloody put it away into some sort of fund that gives them 3% or 4%. Yeah. And they're getting their 30,000 of their 1 million, and they'd rather not give their million away because they have to give it to their chota and mota and lota.
Yeah.
So as a result, they're not really doing anything with their millions. 2-3 million locked away in some fund, making them a little bit of money so they can live off it, right? Mm. They don't give it in the cause of Allah. So millionaires are usually pretty stingy. And in my donation strategies, in my charities, I found millionaires are pretty stingy people. So who are the real givers? They're the billionaires.
Mm.
So I set a criteria. I said, number two, after giving everything away, second plan is I need to find billionaires that have become billionaires from zero in one lifetime. So I found 17 billionaires.
Wow.
Right? Three non-Muslims and about 14 Muslims. And I spent time with them and I called them up and said, listen, steak dinner, okay? And I'm buying a nice coffee and I just want to ask you some questions. So I met 17 billionaires in the year 2015, sat down with them one-to-one. It was easy because I had a bit of a name and profile.
Yeah.
I even sat down with Tony Fernandez, for example, on AirAsia.
Right.
And I sat down with him and I said, who the hell are you? What the hell makes you so good? And why does God give you wealth and not me? And I found the following. Okay, this is amazing. You should do it. Okay, number one thing I found that they were all very simple people. Okay, nothing unique about them. No one had an MBA. No one had a Princeton degree. No one had an Ivy League education. No one. And I was far more eloquent than them in speaking. And you know, I smelled better than them. I dressed better than them. And you know what? They weren't particularly attractive. They were, you know, no one was using the image or their status. Nobody, none of them came from very wealthy, rich families. They were all born from middle-class families. Okay, so that was number one, which gave me reassurance. I didn't need to have anything special quality that they had, which gave them an edge. No. The second thing I realized is that they found an edge. It's called an edge, a bit like, you know, I have found an axe that's very sharp. We need to find our sharp axe, whatever it is. Okay. But the difference is as follows, is that they took their axe and they kept on chop faster. And all they figured out is how to do that million times faster than anybody else. That's it. But if that one edge that they have gives them 2% or 5% or 3% profit, they just figure out how to speed it up. That's all that was there. And I can give you the example of Sheikh Khalid al-Shithri for Hafidhullah. The other day I met him, I started laughing. He laughed. And why is he laughing? Because one of his companies bought a property from another company and they don't even know each other. So he's laughing. Yeah. So I said, how did you make money? He said, this is how I did it. I had 100,000 riyals. I bought a piece of land. Then I straight away put it onto the market.
Yeah.
And everyone said, look, Khalid, you're stupid. Wait for 2 years. Let it go up 10, 20%. Then sell it. He said, no, I'm going to put it in the market. He put it up for just 5%. He found someone to buy it for 5%. With that 105,000, then he bought another one. And he put it again only at 5%. What ended up happening? He just put that 5%, made it flip over 10 times. But the biggest impact was that in the market, his name was established that Khalid buys and sells property all the time. So people thought I had so much money. Mm. They didn't know it was the same 100,000. So people started offering me deals. People started offering me money. Before I knew it, he had become 14 billion Saudi riyals within 12 years. 14 billion from 100,000 riyals. So I said, you know what? That's it. That's how I got started. When I had nothing, I ended up at the hospital.
Mm.
And I just sold my hospital last year, alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. What's next?
A group of hospitals, inshallah.
Inshallah.
And a property fund, inshallah. To focus on land banking and property development in Australia, inshallah.
In Australia?
In Australia, inshallah. I hope it works, inshallah. Let's see.
No, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala get it.
I mean,
what's your edge, Sheikh?
My edge, I think, my edge is I can make people do things they don't want to do. I think as some of my team members says that you can make people leave their jobs.
Mm.
And I think that's right. I actually can.
Yeah.
And a lot of people might listen to my lectures and actually literally change their course because you know what? They says, you know, this guy literally he proved that it actually can be done. That's my edge. And I think in business, my edge is probably healthcare. It is just the most easiest Makes thing in sense. The world for me. Yeah, it just comes so natural and easy for me. Not because I'm a doctor. It's just the easiest sector for me to enter. Yeah.
Alhamdulillah. Well, Jazakallah khair, Sheikh. I rarely make notes where I'm actually like learning stuff in a podcast. But Kabzi will tell you that. But that's been really helpful. Jazakallah khair, and I'm sure hopefully hundreds of thousands will benefit.
Look, I'd just like to say that, look, you're doing an excellent job. Please keep doing it, okay? Don't worry about the size of who you are at the moment. Opportunity will strike and the fulcrum of chains will and all the chains will come together and all the hub and the spokes will come together and you will accelerate very quickly. My suggestion would be just disrupt the thinking of the Muslimin. What got us here will not get us there. We have new challenges. A day does not come except that the fitna and that day is worse than the day before. So we have to think differently. And that's what makes us different and is because we think different, not just because we are different, right?
Yeah.
So it's very critical you continuously challenge. And I would ask you to challenge the mashayikh and the ulama, especially the most rigid people on this earth. They are the ones that need to change and challenge, not because they want to. I want them to become, leave the Quran and Sunnah. No, use the Quran and Sunnah, but understand the challenges of the modern society, and think outside the box. Yeah, and benefit from what all the people around us have done. We live amongst non-Muslims, has benefit from their knowledge, not just in English and maths and science, but really the strategies that they've done. And the final thing I'm going to say is conquer your fears, your worst fears. And I realized from my life that the fear of fear is worse than the fear itself.
Mm.
Okay? In fact, when you put yourself in a situation of fear, you actually, it's not that bad, really. And I think COVID taught us that, right? COVID taught us that. We're still here. We're still, you know, doing well, even though a lot of us did go through great difficulties. But mashallah, you know what? Despite that, we're still here. So put yourself in a situation of fear and trust Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to get it done for you. And Allah azawajal will, if you do trust Him, He will get it done for you. But just enjoy the ride initially. There's a ride, a roller coaster ride that He puts you through.
Yeah.
Enjoy the ride because it's going to end.
Barakallah feek, Shaykh. It's been a real pleasure.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Salaam alaikum.
Salaam alaikum.